Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning. Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer. Colonel Muammar Gaddafi is insisting he will fight until the last drop of his blood to stay in power. After a violent crackdown resulting in hundreds of deaths, protesters are retreating in Tripoli. But Gaddafi has less control over the rest of the country, and everyone's wondering, will he or won't he be ousted like the autocratic rulers of Tunisia and Egypt were? Renowned political theorist, distinguished fellow at Demos, and Libya expert Benjamin Barber says that either way, the outcome is likely to be tragic rather than democratic. He'll explain why he thinks that. Plus, we'll ask him why he resigned yesterday from the board of the Gaddafi International Charity and Development Foundation and why he was on that board to begin with. Dr. Benjamin Barber, welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning. Now, you wrote on the Huffington Post yesterday that Gaddafi is less Mubarak and more Castro. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, he is in the model of somebody who was a revolutionary founder of a modern nationalist state in Libya. He came to power back in 1969, when many of your listeners probably weren't born, and he came to power as a revolutionary liberator of Libya from a monarchy in close touch with the Italian colony and the Italian colonial rulers. And when he first came on the scene, he came on the scene as a revolutionary. So, you know, you now have his regime, which is without question a tyrannical and, as we've seen recently, capable of barbarism in its responses, but a regime that goes all the way back to a revolutionary founding. And this is a man who sees himself in terms of revolutionary socialism, revolutionary nationalism, a very different character than somebody like Mubarak, who was a third generation, you know, he's no Nasser. He was someone who took over after Sadat was assassinated, or say Barsha, the governor and ruler of Syria today, who is somebody who was an ophthalmologist in London, and when his father, Hafiz Assad, died, was called to take power. Those are figures who are modern, technocratic, bureaucratic. They're still tyrants, by the way, but a very different breed. So we have in Gaddafi a breed that really, you know, we understand little about nowadays and who harkens back to another era and who is a genuine revolutionary and who I suspect, therefore, when Libya goes down and his regime goes down, as it seems likely to do, will die fighting for it rather than find a comfortable exile in Sharm el-Sheikh.
Now, I was alive in 1969. I was in grade school, so I don't quite remember that moment. But I do remember, you know, Gaddafi and the Lockerbie bombing and sort of, you know, the whole way in which he was really portrayed by the U.S. media as, and, you know, the sort of searing image I have in my mind is sort of like a Saddam Hussein-like character, like really a sort of crazy, arbitrary leader. But then there was this sort of rapprochement over the weapons of mass destruction in which he was sort of little maybe rehabilitated. But now, of course, that's all sort of unraveling. It's hard for me to follow all of those twists and turns.
Well, it is, and it's a long history because you're talking, of course, about the 1980s in the period when he was involved in ways that are still not wholly clear in ordering the bombing, the bringing down of the Lockerbie flight that resulted in hundreds and hundreds of deaths. But that was already in the 80s, and that was a time, you may remember, when Ronald Reagan had ordered air attacks on the Gaddafi compound in Tripoli, and when his daughter was actually killed in the bombing of a residence. By the way, yesterday, for those who watched this crazy kind of rambling, angry speech that he gave, he stood in front of that residence that has been preserved as a bombed-out shell as a memorial to, you know, the American attack and the death of his daughter. So, you know, this is a man who's been through a lot, but we're talking in 1969, about 20 years before that, and like so many people, including Castro himself, who came to power then in the fervor of revolutionary nationalism and revolutionary socialism and anti-Americanism, you know, he had weathered, by the time we got to the 80s, he had weathered 20 years of being seen as an enemy of the West and an enemy of America. And, of course, that's in his bones and in his blood, and he's now reverted to kind of the ferocious revolutionary brute, if you like, who was back then. But, again, we have to understand this is not some memorial, not some modern dictator who is relying on the technocratic firepower of his military.
Wait, you said Mubarak, but you meant Gaddafi, right?
No, I said he's not like Mubarak.
Oh, not like Mubarak.
He's not a Mubarak. He's not somebody.
So how is he hanging? How is he hung on to power all these years, if not
well,
through military
means? Well, the other factor we have to look at here is that you want to remember that before 1931, there was no Libya. There were three different countries in that region: Tripolitania, Fazan, and Cyrenaica, and they were controlled by tribes. North Africa is a tribal, a desert tribe nation, and to this day, the clans and tribes still play a significant role. We're not talking here about an urban middle class of the sort we found in Cairo. We're talking about a nation still, to some extent, dividing along clan lines. In the east, in Benghazi and Tobruk, where there's been such a successful uprising, that's the home of rival clans that have been trying to bring Gaddafi down for 30 years. These are the same people in Benghazi who arrested the so-called nurses and doctor who were supposedly responsible for infecting children with AIDS in Benghazi hospitals. They arrested them in order to create an embarrassment for Gaddafi, and it took Gaddafi 10 years to resolve the problem and get the hostages back out of the country. So we tend to look at Libya from afar as a singular nation state, but the reality is it is also a tribal state, it is also a clan state, and the initial uprising, the impetus for it, came from clans in Benghazi who were, yes, interested in liberty and freedom, but also interested in overthrowing the clan rival who had been in control in Tripoli in the West for these last 42 years.
My guest is Benjamin Barber, fellow at Demos, political theorist, Andrea Bernstein, in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're talking about Libya. So you, in fact, say in your article in the Huffington Post about Saif Gaddafi, the son of Muammar Gaddafi, that he sort of, that in the end, those sort of family ties and the tribalism won out, that he'd been somebody sort of leading, however tepid, a reform movement. But as of this week or this weekend, he no longer is. Can you explain that?
Sure. Well, let me say first that, you know, there are two different stories, in a sense, about Saif Gaddafi, the second eldest son of Gaddafi's. One, and it's the popular story you'll hear on CNN and the BBC, is that he's just another thuggish son of a thuggish dictator, and to the extent he was doing things in the so-called reform area earlier, that was all just hypocrisy. The apple never drops far from the tree, and all the sons are thick as thieves and part of the same butchery that the father represents. That's the one story, and that's the most common story being told. But I know the other story, and frankly, the other story is much more credible, and that's the story of one son among the six who went to London, who spent 5 years there and earned a PhD degree from the London School of Economics in political philosophy, who came back to Libya and founded the Gaddafi Foundation. It's not the Muammar Gaddafi Foundation, the Colonel Gaddafi Foundation. It's the Saif Gaddafi Foundation for Charity and Development. And that foundation became Saif's instrument for an effort at reform and change. It included a human rights division, and Saif became a champion of trying to get people out of prison who had been imprisoned by the regime. It became a place where there was an attempt to transform Islamic fighters from Al-Qaeda who had been imprisoned in Libya to get them to renounce violent Islam and find another way, and that was quite successful. About 100 people were released. That foundation became the outpost for reform, and it had an international board on which I served, on which Hernando de Soto, the great Peruvian economist, served, on which Rich Roberts, a Nobel laureate from the United States, served, on which the Italian prime minister and the Greek prime minister served. It was a very, very important instrument of change and reform, and for a number of years, SAFE tried to make it an instrument of change.
Until this weekend.
Until this weekend. If you listen carefully to the speech he gave on Sunday night, the first third of the speech was about the work of the foundation and about the need for a constitutional convening of all forces and peoples in Libya to talk about reform and change. But the second part of the speech became a dire warning against, if you didn't do that, what might happen if civil war broke out and rivers of blood flows. And the third and worst part of the speech, he then said, and I, for one, have to embrace my father, have to embrace the defense of the regime, and I will do so to the death if I have to. And that, of course, is the part of the speech that was widely reported, and properly so, because in it, Saif Gaddafi, in effect, martyred his own 7 or 8 years of reform work in order to come together with his family and the regime and say he will defend it to the death. And in a sense, he chose sides at that point in a way that doomed all of the important and meaningful work he had done towards reform.
Now, I suppose that, I mean, you know, there could be some that would argue, knowing all that you know about Libya, that you should have seen that coming and that, you know, to be on any foundation with the name Gaddafi was sort of setting yourself up for just this kind of a fall.
Yes, that's true. And on the other hand, I've spent my entire life looking for a peaceful road to reform and democracy. I personally will say here on the air today, I do not believe that violent revolution or even uprising and protest in the streets is necessarily the best way to get to democracy. You will note, and I hope all those who criticize me for looking for a slow road, a reform road to democracy, I hope you will all note that as of today, there is not a single regime in the Middle East or North Africa that has in any way become more democratic. I applaud and celebrate what happened in the streets of Cairo. But the supreme military command council that rules Egypt today is ruled by Field Marshal Tantawi, who is a longstanding defense minister of Egypt and a close comrade of Mubarak, and by Prime Minister Shafik, who is the prime minister who Mubarak put into power at the beginning of the uprising to try to save himself. They still run Egypt. In Tunisia, we still haven't seen anything resembling democracy, and in the rest of the area, we are seeing repression, violence, and possibilities of civil war in Bahrain and now also in Libya. So yes, I have believed always that violent revolution is an unlikely road to democracy. Look at France in 1789. Look at St. Petersburg and Moscow in 1917. Look at so many of the revolutions. Castro's revolution was a democratic revolution to overthrow the dictator Batista. And look where that led. So those who say you shouldn't have been working for a peaceful reformist road to political change in the Middle East have yet to prove that their way, violent uprising, uprisings in the street, the throwing out of a figurehead, but not the regime, is a good way to cultivate democracy. Time will tell.
Let's talk about what happens next in Libya. What are the next steps? My guest is Benjamin Barber, the political theorist, a distinguished fellow at Demos. Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer today. So what does happen in Libya? You say, you know, you point out that the sort of basically the opposition, such as there was, the reform movement, crumbled over the weekend when Saif Gaddafi declared his allegiance to his family. So what's the end game? Where does this all end?
Well, you know, of course, in real history, there is no end game. It goes on and on and on. But I think the one thing we know is that what is unlikely to happen anytime soon is any form of democracy. One of the, I mean, I am also a political theorist, aside from having worked in the Middle East and in Libya. And as a political theorist, any political theorist of democracy will tell you that the successful democracies in the world have been the result of long, hard, patient work, the building of civic institutions, the building of civil society, the building of citizenship, experienced, competent citizens able to make elections real, not just the phony elections we've seen in many dictatorships around the world. It's a long, slow, difficult, patient process. Take the American Revolution. We started in 1776. We achieved something like a non-slave free republic only after the Civil War, 80 years later, and a violent, costly struggle that we paid for, as Lincoln said, in blood. So it's a slow, difficult process, and the idea that it's going to be achieved quickly by the kinds of things that are happening in Libya or perhaps even in Cairo is simply to misunderstand the nature of how democracies are created. As a consequence, I would suggest that what we're going to probably get in Libya is either ongoing civil war with Gaddafi hanging in the west around Tripoli and trying to put down, and that will not be successful, the revolt in the south and in the eastern parts of Libya, or what we will get is the overthrow of Gaddafi, chaos. There is no, it's not like Egypt where there's a well-organized military or a middle-class bureaucracy. So what we will get if Gaddafi goes is a kind of chaos, clan warfare, and probably at some point the reimposition of some kind of stable rule via one or another of the clan leaders waiting to replace Gaddafi. And with the death of the reform movement, the disappearance of the foundation, the resignation of its liberal constitutional director, a brilliant and wonderful constitutional scholar in Libya who was guiding the foundation on the reform path, with those people pushed aside, it seems to me very unlikely you're going to see progress towards democracy. Let me say, Andrew, I want to say one thing. Several people responding to the HuffPost and elsewhere have said, you're just one of these neocons who doesn't believe the Arab people are capable of democracy. Far from it. The Arab people, the Libyan people, the Egyptian people are every bit as capable of democracy as anywhere else on earth, but everywhere democracy has been difficult. Looking at the Congress today, at the Tea Party, at what's going on in Wisconsin, some people might say Americans aren't very capable of democracy either, and you know we're having a hard time with it.
We're almost out of time on the segment, and I will stipulate to that point because I did want to talk to you about the sort of international response and what it should be, sort of given the, you know, array of unpalatable options. So Secretary of State Clinton said yesterday the violence unleashed against the protesters is, quote, completely unacceptable, and the United States will take, quote, appropriate steps to deal with the situation. France and Germany threatened to hit Libya with EU sanctions for the crackdown, and the European Union said the violence in Libya could not constitute, quote, crimes against humanity, and urged an independent probe, excuse me, that could constitute crimes against humanity, and urged an independent probe. So is the international community doing enough? And is
it's all rhetoric. There's nothing it really can do short of armed intervention by NATO to, say, clear the airspace so Gaddafi can't use airplanes and helicopters against his people. That can't happen. It won't happen. It would be an infringement of sovereignty, and it would be vetoed in the Security Council by Russia and China if the UN tried to do it. So all the Western powers and Clinton and Obama have is, at this point, very weak power of talk, of rhetoric, and they will make noises and they will condemn and they will say that's too bad, and they're right, it is terrible and it ought to be stopped. But we live in a world where it's impossible to intervene in the internal affairs, even when a revolution is going on, without inviting the charge of imperialism and colonialism. One of the true things that Saif Gaddafi said Sunday night in his speech was that if we don't get our act together, if there's a civil war here, it could invite foreign intervention. And we've already seen noises being made in that direction. But given the realities on the ground, I suspect what we will see is a lot of talk and no action,
but
typical of how the West responds.
Even if there was action, short of, you know, I mean, even some kind of military intervention, you know, the sort of most extreme scenario that you're laying out. If I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying that doesn't make a difference on the ground in Libya because there still is no democratic institution to take over.
That would not make a difference. And indeed, it might, if I was a conspiratorial thinker, intervention by Western military might be the one thing that could bring Gaddafi back, because he would be vindicated in his crazy claim that the whole revolutionary uprising is the doing of foreigners.
And that's what happened when
now appear,
right?
You know, to enforce the revolution, one could well imagine that he would seem vindicated, and that would actually restabilize his power.
And that is what happened when his daughter was killed.
Exactly so. Exactly so.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much, political theorist Benjamin Barber, distinguished fellow at Demos, author of a Huffington Post article yesterday about the situation in Libya. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Andrew.
And when we come back, we'll talk about the future of magazines with New York Times reporter David Carr.